Fiat money has a collection of malincentives and consequences for the degrading and rotting of society. As we covered in the first part of our Fiat series, it leads to mindless consumerism and a more materialist culture. And as we continue, I want to cover something today, something else that it does by bleeding our savings, which is essentially our bet on the future capacity of society to provide for us. What happens when you are forced to bet against the future, as well as it artificially lowering the price to replace things in the economy until an enormous amount of the economic engine is built around quick financing, low-quality products, and then throwing it in the trash to finance the next thing. It's time for a Guys Take episode. This is the Fiat Replacement Theory. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. This show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, the place to buy Bitcoin and plug your life into a Bitcoin standard, your business, your retirement, you name it, check them out. And of course, CoinKite, the makers of the Cold Card hardware wallet to keep your Bitcoin safe. And honestly, especially with the news recently of the Apple M-Series attack vector, so for anybody who doesn't know, the M-Series Max, like basically what I am using right now on my computer, which are phenomenal chips, there is a new side channel attack discovered that essentially allows them to reveal any and apparently any and all cryptographic keys being used within an application on an M-Series Mac. Now, as I understand it, the way this works is essentially there's a mechanism inside the M-Series chips that will essentially predict patterns of use and then load stuff into RAM or load stuff into the cache directly on the chip in preparation for next actions. And this is referred to as DMP, and it's a huge performance boost to the device, to using the device. But apparently there's two different, and I didn't quite understand this, is essentially two different ways of categorizing information or categorizing what data is being pooled, something between a pointer and an address, and I don't quite understand the difference, but essentially what's able to happen is that if you have a malicious piece of software on your computer with just user access, by the way, you don't need root access for this, it can talk with a device or with a different application that does have cryptographic keys that is trying to secure passwords or backups to things that you have on your computer. And as a quote-unquote side-channel attack, what that means is that it's pulling the data through a different means. It's interpreting or recognizing what the data is through some other metric. So like a good example of a side-channel attack is that, like, I can't see your keyboard or I don't have a visibility or like, I don't have like a keylogger or anything, so I can't see like what's happening with your keyboard. But if I can get access to your microphone, I can listen to it. And then based on the cadence of your typing, I can actually recreate exactly what you were typing because of the sound of the keys and the speed with which you move from one key to another. So that's a side channel attack. It's using some other metric about the information in order to actually pull something from it. And so what apparently is being done here is, when it's trying to extract keys, is it's talking with this application in this kind of like prefetching mode of trying to get stuff ready in the cache, and then it can pull that information from the cache and analyze things about it. And in doing so, it can force One of the examples that one of the researchers used in the source to this, I said, imagine you've got a secret and an application is holding a secret and you have an input X, and every time you give it an input, it uses that secret and it outputs Y, and then it's storing Y in the cache. Well, every time that they are able to quote unquote dereference Y, which is essentially doing this trick to remove take it from a pointer and turn it into an address, which allows them to essentially find, I think, the actual pieces of data, like where they exactly are on the drive or in the memory. Every single time they're able to pull this dereferencing off, they're able to gain just a little bit more, just like one little piece of S, and start to compile it together. So it's essentially a brute force side channel attack where they can just keep trying over and over and over again. And apparently for like a 2048 RSA key, they pulled it off in 2 hours. And they tried a handful of other keys, a quantum resistant key and all of this stuff, and not a whole lot of difference was made. It was just kind of the difference in time. And like one of them took 10 hours, I think, and another one was like 10 minutes. But all of this is just to say, it's to explain why it is that these devices are inherently insecure. There's so many different attack vectors, and this is why you must keep your keys separate from your device. Do not keep digital backups unless it is of a hot wallet. That is the only time that behind some sort of set of cryptographic keys, I keep a digital backup, and that's because I think of my hot wallets as high risk wallets. Now there is a way to mitigate this. It can't be patched on the Apple side, but it can be quote unquote patched on the software side. But it just means that there needs to be some way for them to delineate whether or not it uses DMP, this like prefetching feature, and it heavily slows down the performance of the device for the cryptographic function, which, you know, they talk about this like in the couple of articles that I read. They're like, oh, it's gonna like kill performance, but it's like the cryptographic operation is so small in the context of like most of the operations being done. I don't really see that as being like some sort of a huge problem. I don't even think most people would even notice. And the M3 series apparently has a dot, like a command, essentially a bit or something that can be sent to deactivate the DMP for specific operations, and that's essentially what needs to be done. But I don't think the M1 or M2, or at least in the couple of articles that I read, I don't think they had anything about this in the source, that I didn't actually go through the entire thing. But the M1 and M2 chips do not have that embedded, like, temporarily turn this off for these specific functions. Option or bit, whatever the hell it was. I don't really know the architecture of chips well enough to understand what the hell they're talking about. But with that, this is such an important reason as to why you keep your keys separate. You have cold storage and you get yourself a freaking hardware wallet. Just do it. And my discount code for cold card specifically is Bitcoin Audible. But honestly, just get yourself any hardware wallet. Also, this is actually a really good reason to use something like the Tap Signer for mobile, because it's like kind of that one step removed and it doesn't require any power or anything, so it's even quicker than the cold card. But I don't care, this wasn't intended as an ad for CoinKite or anything. Just get a hardware wallet and keep your keys off of your devices. Apparently there was a similar attack on the A series chips, the iPhone chips, at some time in the past, and this is when they came up with like standard time computing or something, where like all blocks are done with the exact same amount of computation time. But this doesn't fix the DMP problem on the new devices, and apparently the DMP is on the M series. Again, this is a feature. This is a huge optimization feature. Apparently, it's super aggressive, and that's why it's really difficult to mitigate. So just keep your cold storage off of your devices. Also, update. There will be a lot of software updates in response to this. People trying to make patches in software, especially probably Bitcoin wallets and things. So if you see updates come in, this would be a very important time and one of the critical reasons as to why you want to update. However, for today's episode, for today's Guy's Take, I wanted to dig back into our fiat series and talk about something I've been thinking about a lot lately on the idea of fiat and investment. And there are a couple of different perspectives that I think are worth diving into on this that will require a couple of different episodes, maybe two, maybe three. But today's I'm labeling, or I'm referring to it as the fiat replacement theory. And it's something that I believe naturally occurs when you discount the value of the future. And ultimately, that is what fiat money does by diluting the value of the money. And what's funny is that in any other context, in any investment context, we would actually know, this would be obvious that this would actually be the effect. But we don't think about money as a future investment. We don't think about monetary savings as an investment in our future. And that's exactly what it is. It's an investment in society's future by withdrawing our desire or our need to consume today and betting, essentially investing those resources, those consumable goods that we would have used up, those scarce resources, that scarce, you know, labor, the human labor that we need to accomplish something or to consume something or to use something up, we instead leave those goods and services and that capital in the economy by saving money. And that money is essentially our hedge. It's our bet that the future is going to be better. The future is going to provide us with something that we cannot get today or that we do not need today. And there will be a time or a reason or a feature or a technology that will make it worthwhile in the future. It's saying the future is going to be meaningfully better. Therefore, it is worth keeping my promise from society to get those resources back. So what happens when you devalue, when you dilute that promise, that investment in the future? Well, what's funny is that you can actually, it's actually all of the things that they say. It encourages spending. It quote-unquote boosts economic activity, which it doesn't actually boost any sustainable economic activity or any positive economic activity. It simply accelerates a whole bunch of pointless spending, as they claim that they want is just a whole bunch of spending and for without any concrete purpose. They even just say they just want to boost spending. What kind of spending? Doesn't matter. We just want to boost it. And this is a huge part of the problem with the idea of using GDP and just arbitrary nominal economic activity as a metric, is because there's no quality understanding. There's no quality judgment. There's no subjective value actually being transmitted into the economy. When you're just chasing a higher GDP, you end up just kind of regurgitating or just tracking how much new money is issued into the system and basically nothing else. So you could have a complete and total drop in the quality, in the foundation, in the sustainability, in every important metric of actual important metric of the economy, chasing just a number, just a higher GDP, just a, like you measured it with a ruler and it's like, yep, the economy's bigger now. But let's go back to what savings means. So just from a fundamental idea, savings is the net creation of resources. It is a call option on society. I gave society more resources than I consumed because I think society is going to do something useful with it. And therefore, I am going to wait to consume. I'm going to wait to take it back out until I think society has something better to offer me. Not only am I specifically preparing for my future, I am saving so that I have something to call upon at a later date. I am doing it specifically because I am trusting that society will have something to call upon. My savings is in cans of food and chickens and all of those other things when I think society is going to die. Because I need the actual things. The money is of no use in a future where there's nothing to buy, where society is just a disaster. So what happens when I am incentivized to spend now and not actually save anything? I'm literally taking the future's resources and using them up today. It's essentially a forced put option. I am forced to short the future for the benefit of right now at this very moment. But you know what that means? That means eventually I have to pay for it. I mean, that's the whole concept of debt, is that I eat a whole bunch of stuff now and I do it on a credit card, but in 10 years when this credit card bill is ridiculous, I'm gonna have to not only pay back what I ate, but I'm gonna have to pay it back with interest. I'm gonna have to pay back like 2 or 3 times as much as I actually ate, as much as I consumed. Now, if we did this just once or twice and prices were actually accurate, then this wouldn't be a problem. We would just have the people who bet wrong, you know, pay for their overconsumption. We would have the people who allowed that consumption pay for their foolish, you know, investment or exchange with those people, etc., etc. You would actually have a market price that exposed that risk and made it well known that, you know, this is the cost of making these, of engaging in these bad behaviors and this poor planning. But what happens? All of that economic activity, all of that economic coordination and calculation is only possible because of the money, though. Every bit of it. All of the intersubjective, the network communication, the network measurement, the societal, did we do better or did we do worse, part of that equation is only possible with the money. Because the money is the intersubjective thing that allows us to compare my value to yours. So what happens when you poison the money? Specifically so that you encourage pointless consumption today at the future's explicit expense. You are literally forcing society to bet that the future will be shitty. And because this is an irreversible, this isn't like an option on a stock, this is to genuinely just go ahead and use up the capital as fast as you can. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It just means we will have less capital for the future because we're using it up now, and there's no way to get around that. And it constantly lowers the price of financing, which is further and further stealing from the future in order to pay for today. So you're cannibalizing all of the hope that your country will actually be better off one day. And there's so many negative effects of this. But why do I specifically refer to this one element that we're about to talk about, the fiat replacement theory? Is because it incentivizes people to just go ahead and replace whatever isn't working properly. So what do I mean by that? If it is artificially cheap to get financing and just replace something, then the far more difficult long-term approach of preserving and making something that is easy to preserve and maintain is just going to continually get ignored. And it's going to get worse and worse the longer and longer time goes on, because you will have generations of people that have grown up thinking that it's just easy to finance and replace, finance and replace. Think about it in the context of cars. I'm sure a lot of you guys, especially Bitcoiners, have older cars, and you spend a lot of time trying to fix it. And it's an annoying, as someone who has spent their entire life in old crappy cars, and actually today has the closest thing to a new car ever since Rad was born, all of the crap that breaks and stuff, I don't have an old car. It's 6 years old now. I mean, that's not brand new, but it's not ancient either. But all of the little gadgets and the little things that are breaking on it, the whole thing is financed. I just got it on fiat debt. And arguably, it was the smart decision, because when Bitcoin was low, I certainly wasn't going to just cash out a whole bunch of Bitcoin and buy a depreciating shitty car asset. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to get some fantastic car. Like, every car that I see. It was amazing. I just went from car dealership to car dealership, and we drove a Hyundai, and we drove a Nissan, and we drove a Kia, and just every damn thing under the sun, and nothing stood out to me. Nothing. I can't believe how much quote unquote shopping we did. And then every single time I walked away, and I'd be like, which one was the Hyundai? Which one was the Nissan? All the interfaces for like the controls and stuff inside looked like they were made by the exact same team. They all sucked. It was like 6 buttons to get to anything important in the stupid interface. It was all slow. It like worked like those old GPSs. Like, I hate the electronics in cars. Like, it just despise it beyond end. And then to find out that it's all because of like unions forcing them to use the same companies that don't know jack shit about designing an interface or designing electronics, and forcing the companies to actually continue to use them and not work with, like, not just stick like a fucking iPad. Like, my like 10-year-old iPad works better than the stupid thing in our car, and it's a permanent fixture. Like, you can't change it. But anyway, good God. And then all the interior and stuff, it's all basically the same. It's the most forgettable set of products I could possibly think of. None of them have a unique look. They all just like mesh together in my mind. There are so few unique, lasting, like, I feel like somebody really put some thought into it cars. It's like everybody's just trying to copy everybody else in this whole zone of the market of just finance and replace. And you know, if it's just going to be refinance and you just have this huge market of people that maybe it was only 10% of the market before, maybe now it's 25% because fiat money just sucks so bad and everybody's financing the old thing. So they just sell it and they just roll that financing over into a new thing. They just swap one, they never actually own anything. They just swap the rental, the bank rental of car number one for bank rental of car number two for the bank rental of car number three. And then this is now the market to satisfy. Now the people who are actually making the products and services be like, well, if everybody's just going to finance and replace, because it's hard to maintain, it's hard to have something last a long time, it's hard to spend the time and energy needed to preserve something of value than it is to just make a cheap replacement, and when it starts to break, make a new cheap replacement. And now if everybody's got easy financing that should be at 20% interest rates, but instead it's like 6% interest rates because the government and the banking system is just waving a magic wand and just poofing money out of thin air by the hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars every year. Well, if that's what the market is, why the hell would you take the time to make something that was easy to maintain? Why would you redesign the car so that you could easily replace this portion of it, or that you could actually take a transmission out and put it back in a $7,000-$8,000 car, and that it wouldn't total the car because it doesn't cost $7,000-$8,000 to replace the transmission. I use this example because I have a car in my driveway right now that is literally totaled. The only other car that we own is technically totaled because to get it done, to actually replace the transmission, I mean, obviously I can get a $1,000 transmission or whatever, and I can have my brother and his friend, or even I, we could go drive it, 2 hours all the way back home, and we can do it in our garage. But that's just a week's worth of a job. Like, that's a nightmare, and it might as well cost me $7,000 or $8,000 because I don't have the time to do that shit. But to replace it with a used transmission at the place that I went to, they're like, yeah, it's totaled, it's done. And I was like, well, no, like, what's it gonna cost? And he's like, well, it's totaled, like, the car's just old enough. And they're like, no, the car works. And they're like, it's gonna be like $7,800 or something. So the incentive to actually make the product maintainable starts to go away. And this may even be as technology makes it easier to maintain. So even despite this disincentive, there may actually be, you'll probably get a lot of products and services that actually still do have great longevity, that actually do end up being easy to work on. But it's not because any incentives actually align that way. It's because the natural human incentive is to not make shit. And thank God that that is actually able to shine through despite all of this, because we are literally incentivized to avoid it at all costs, to just finance and replace. Just throw it in the garbage. Just put it in the dump. Just sell it to somebody who's going to deal with all the headache. And increasingly, more and more products, especially those that actually come up, that actually become a thing in, you know, more recent years, like during this era, those sorts of products just end up being built as replaceable. Think about it. How often has really the form factor of your phone changed? Now, tech is also a special example just because it's moving so fast. This incentive is already there just naturally because the progress and the innovation in the space is so incredibly accelerated that you're more likely to just get a new device because of the RAM capability or the CPU or the screen density, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, the heavy centralization in the economy, which is also, it's not entirely based on this. Some of it's just the technological limitations of certain markets, but it also is highly incentivized by the fiat apparatus because everybody that is already big is necessarily, quote unquote, more creditworthy, even though from the context of an investment, it's not. If I put in $1 billion into a, $400 billion company, I'm not going to make a 20% return. But if I put $1 billion into $1 billion company, that company might actually grow 20%. That company might grow 300%. And then looking at, putting that capital to even smaller and smaller endeavors, small endeavors are the ones that have the potential to grow. So the actual credit worthiness is based on the ability to execute and the value of the idea. Whereas the idea of just like throwing billions of dollars at huge companies should actually get you a very small return. But the problem is that if you have the money supply being constantly inflated, and so everything just kind of goes up in price always, and you just look at, everybody's chasing the nominal GDP, and S&P 500 pays back 7% every year. All you needed to do is beat the S&P, and the big companies, by the nature of being big companies that already have huge dominant places in the market, they're going to get shit tons of debt. They're going to get shit tons of credit, and they're going to get a ton of people that just blanket, like blind invest in them because they make nominal returns that they shouldn't actually make. They don't have the capacity to grow in the market like small companies do. And they don't have enough good ideas to execute on all of this capital that's just flooding into it. Why? Because all of the stuff is just being issued unsustainably. Nobody even knows what to put it towards because it's resources that we don't actually have. It's like we have 10 houses worth of resources, and thus, we have 10 people who actually did all of that work and have that capital available to them to actually put it towards some other goal or idea in the economy. And maybe they have a variety of ideas. Some of them are going to work. Some of them aren't. But there's not just an endless sea of all of the things that we could tackle right now. There are things that are optimal for right now and for our environment. And if we just overinvest in something that turns out to be a transitionary phase, or that should never have been as big of a market as it actually gets incentivized to be, then all we're doing is having people use up, in the context of those 10 houses, you have a whole bunch of people that didn't even do any of the production, didn't even build any of the houses, that gets issued a ton of debt. And then what do these huge companies do? There's like one huge company. What are they going to do? They're just going to buy up all the houses. They're just going to look for something of value to park all of that financing that's going to keep up with inflation or do better. And in the context of our economy and all of the billion-dollar companies, the huge centralized platforms and companies that have huge networks, what happens? They get access to essentially an unbelievable amount of way priced below the market debt. Stuff that actual savings would not go to in a savings economy, and something that at a 20% interest rate, a 30% interest rate, they would not be able to use. They would not be able to do. What do? They run around, they just buy up small companies. Every small competitor that comes up, I'm just going to get financing, I'm going to buy it. They're not going to be able to come up with a billion brilliant ideas. What are they going to do? They are just going to go around and they are going to buy up everybody else's ideas. And all of those other people are going to look like a high-risk environment. They're going to look like a difficult bet to make in the credit markets. Why? Because it's actually a potential innovation. Because it's actually got potential growth. Of course, it's higher risk. But if you're just trying to keep up with inflation and you have this giant company that's just this huge network of customers and they've already set themselves up as the premier company for this industry, well, there's no risk. There's no risk. There shouldn't be any reward, and it should be still very costly for them to use up everybody else's resources and savings, but they don't have to. They get to steal it by virtue of the bank creating it out of thin air and reallocating those resources to them fraudulently, and then paying an interest rate back to the bank who never made or owned any of the resources to begin with. It is a giant fraud that fuels. It's like putting fire on the gasoline of the already big companies. And they just, the whole economy just slowly gets soaked up and more centralized. And this leads to a constant and slow degradation in competition around the economy because risk gets divested from. The show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, the place to buy Bitcoin, to plug your life into a Bitcoin standard. It is the full financial suite of Bitcoin services. I actually just did a smash buy of Bitcoin a little while ago. I was really hoping we would get a dip, and it doesn't really look like it anymore. And I was sitting on a little bit of extra fiat, so all right, it's time to just go ahead and buy some Bitcoin. I literally did it in a couple of seconds in the app because the app's right there. That's how I buy my Bitcoin. But if you want to invest in your IRA, you want to set up an IRA and invest in Bitcoin tax-free, you want to be able to get it on your business treasury. You want an employee package where you can pay out part of their salary in Bitcoin. You want to have a vault, the opportunity to do something where Swan actually holds one of the keys in the case of a disaster scenario. So even if you're uncomfortable with this and you're unfamiliar with this space and you want someone to hold your hand, you want someone to really kind of guide you through this and hold one of those keys so that in the case of a disaster, they can still help you recover your coins. You name it, they've got it. Check it out at swanbitcoin.com/guy. The link is right there in the show notes. The show is also brought to you by CoinKite and the ColdCard hardware wallet. This is how you keep your Bitcoin safe. I actually just walked somebody through setting up the ColdCard the other day. You know, something I always appreciate every time I use it and just really kind of love is the fact that, like, I can plug it into any USB port and I can actually see with the cable that there's no data being transferred, that it's just a magnetic thing with two pins on it, so you know it's just power. And I know that's, like, a silly thing. It's, like, really, really small, but it's one of those things that just shows you the attention to detail and the attention to the security of the ColdCard and of all of their devices that CoinKite really has. They don't just give you the better option. They make it so that you can easily see and verify that you have a better option. And in fact, you can see right through the ColdCard case at all of the components. And they show you right on the thing. You can go to the website and see, and they say, if you really want your keys to never be accessible again, and you want to quote unquote destroy your ColdCard in the disaster case scenario, they point it out right there, and you can actually see it on the board. In fact, I've got it. Hold on a second. I've got it right in front of me. Yeah, it says they're right there on the four, just under where it says Mark IV. There's two little chips, and on the board, it is printed. It says, shoot these. If you want a company that has been around the block, that has been here through all of the years of confusion, of bad software, of rickety, like, hacked-together tools, all the way back from 2011 and has been making Bitcoin security tools and hardware devices for the entire time. They had one of the oldest running, maybe the oldest running company in the space doing this, and who has that degree of attention to detail, who knows this is how you make a product that works in even all of the crazy edge cases, you're looking for a ColdCard. Check them out. My code BitcoinAudible will get you a discount, and the details and links are right in the show notes. Real risk becomes riskier, and just being big and just throwing your money at big stuff gets de-risked. It suddenly appears as if these things are all making significant returns, when a lot of it is self-fulfilling prophecy of people just trying to put their money where they think it's going to keep up with inflation, and therefore giving more capital to allocate to those very institutions that are then just going to go up and swallow up and own everything else in existence. Starts at the top and it works its way down. And you know who never gets any of it? The f***ing little guy. But it's yet another feedback loop on the tendency for now huge companies to think that their incumbent status is irrevocable, is set in stone, so they can get tighter and tighter control and more closed with their system, with their network, with their product. And I think this has a lot to do with why you have increasingly more and more closed systems like the Apple ecosystem. And there's always an excuse. There's always a benefit that can be achieved. Like, there's a lot of great performance from the OS, the iOS, and Apple environment because of a lot of the things that they can control to disallow people from using the battery in this way and that way. But then I just get the battery destroyed with all of the surveillance stuff and all of the things that Apple wants to do. And when they, you know, they say, oh, well, you know, there's only so much control because there's a huge security concern. So we have our AirDrop and all of this stuff, when a better AirDrop could be invented or created by somebody else, but they don't even have that low-level access to the operating system. So they basically disallow competition within their platform. And I think they are essentially subsidized to do this by the nature of the fiat system, by the incentives and the flow of money in a fiat environment. And then when you think about cars, when you think about, you know, your laundry machine and your refrigerator and these things that, like, my parents still have a refrigerator that, like, I don't even know it's from, like, the thing's just a compressor. It's just a compressor with a filter and a fan. Refrigerators used to last a billion years. Appliances in general were built to last. Now they literally treat them like just cheap, like phones. Why? Because I think it's because everybody's just financing to replace it. And even worse is they're making it so you can't fix some of these things. I specifically have an old washer and dryer, and I think we still have the one from that address. I think we are still using that washer and dryer. But I had a heating, not a heat element. Like, it wasn't like an element. It was like a coupler or God, what was the thing called? I don't know. It was a really small thing, and it took me a little while to troubleshoot it. And I found the thing on YouTube, and I called somebody just to see. And they quoted me like a couple of $100 to fix it. And I just ordered the, I found the item that I needed after I troubleshoot and kind of went back and forth a little bit. And ended up finding the piece and replacing it myself, which actually was not even slightly hard. Like, there's just not that many moving pieces to, like, a dryer. I mean, you open it up and it's way less complicated than something like a car. If you can replace something on a car, you can fix anything about a dryer, basically. But I replaced it. The piece was, like, $3. And I think it took me, like, 15 minutes, 20 minutes to replace it. Worked like a charm. Here's the thing. On the new washing machines, on the washing machine that my mother has, you can't fix stuff. And it's not even that, like, and I don't mean it like, oh, you can't open it up and, like, see what's going on, or they make it difficult like an Apple device and they use their own little special screws. I mean it like you can't fix it. It has to have a manufacturer-certified repairman to replace, to reset the computer anytime something goes wrong. So even if you fix it, you still have to pay, like, $100 or $200 for a certified technician to come out and basically press a button. They plug in their little device and they say everything's good to go, and then it turns back on. If you ever wondered why it seems like we're losing control over all of our devices, I think this is a huge part of the equation. There's a lot of reasons. There's actually multiple reasons why fiat actually incentivizes things to not be built to last. And there's a lot of other forces at work that make this harder and harder as time goes on, as you have a larger variety of things in the economy. But this is not a natural trend in the sense that people don't want shit. This is why everyone complains about it. People don't want crap. But the financial decision is to just buy and replace as fast as you can when stuff starts to break. So it basically defunds all of the market around preservation, around user control. And then in making it increasingly dependent, it's so funny how many of these things feed back on themselves. When you have state government, state-sponsored education that degrades into just absolute garbage and, you know, category separations and just a list of things you have to memorize about how the world works, about what all of the quote-unquote scientists have determined, rather than learning how to actually come to those conclusions and actually make those assessments and judgments yourself and explore what could be wrong. Instead of having a process for how to think, how to assess, how to analyze, how to break down, how to prove or verify that something is true, instead we get this long list of bullet points that we have to memorize, and if we don't memorize them properly and we say anything wrong, we get bad marks and we lose our gold stars. Which does not teach us how to think. Quite the contrary, it teaches us out of thinking. It teaches us to do what we are told and listen to what the book says, because that is the truth, that is what you get rewarded for, and you get punished if you deviate, even if the answer is right. There's no quality assessment, there is no judgment of whether or not you are intelligent or whether or not you can reach some, you can complete some task. It is about whether or not you can memorize the bullet points of the things that the government says are accurate. And what happens? We grow up as a dependent society believing that whatever the authority says, as long as government claims it to be true, that must be the truth. And everybody else obviously is stupid if they don't simply believe what the government says, because that's how it's worked forever. That's how you get the gold star, man. That's how you get the gold star. How could you not believe what the government says? I've got a gold star. You're a dum-dum. What happens when you breed a population that can't do anything for themselves and just wants the authority to tell them what to do? Well, you also degrade the preservation and the DIY markets, and you give a giant pool of people where, as long as you just satisfy the finance and replace part of the market, then you can just kind of leave everything to everyone else and just kind of ignore them. And of course, the hackers will figure out to hack, and they'll figure out, you know, the 800 different things that you have to tweak to get around this stuff. But ultimately, they would be a bigger, more important part of the environment. They'd be a bigger, more important part of the market if this wasn't constantly producing a negative feedback loop to just at every stage diminish a little bit more, cheapen a little bit more over here, cheapen the financing a little bit, 0% financing for the first 12 months. Why not just finance it? Why not short the future? Why not just consume as much as I can now and I'll work it off later? So why design the product the last 10 years if you know 90% of your customers are only going to have it for 3 before they swap it for a new financing for a new version? Now all of these things and these little components start breaking. Why even make it so you could easily take it out and put a new one back in? It's a whole lot easier to just kind of stamp it out of one big piece of plastic, and if it breaks, eh, those people will deal with it. They'll figure it out. They're not important customers. Remember, we just need to get a new round of financing. And consider, too, that this is an effect that is independent, that is just because of the idea of decreasing the cost, artificially decreasing the cost of financing, of letting the future pay for something. So even though the effect is largely the same as the constant degrading of the products in order to maintain prices in an inflationary environment, where we get the degradation of the quality and the ingredients of things, or shrinkflation in the amount of actual food and sustenance and weight of a candy bar or some sort of a food item or a can of, you know, tomato soup, whatever. These two effects are actually two different sides of the same coin, so they compound on each other. So not only do we make it easier to finance and replace things, especially larger items that otherwise you would definitely want to have something that you can preserve and maintain over a really long period of time. Going back to the example of the refrigerator, my parents still have like the manila envelope colored refrigerator from 30 years ago or something, but they have brand new washer and dryer, and I think the thing's broken like 2 times already. But just going back to the notion of inflation itself, of what happens when you have rising prices in a market where wages actually stay low. And we'll cover this a little bit more in detail with another episode of this Fiat series. In fact, I might actually do that next week, because I think this is a really, really important one to understand the fact that you never actually catch up in the fiat world, that you're constantly chasing your tail, you're running on a treadmill. And I know a lot of people are like, oh, that's a really great analogy and like visualization, but it's legitimately true. And I want to try to get to the heart of really breaking down the pieces as to why this is how it actually unfolds and why it is so insidious, especially for the middle class and lower classes, and why it destroys the middle class, why you end up in a society that basically doesn't have a middle class. But in short form, just to reinforce the fiat replacement theory, let's go over the inflation degrades quality theory and why we actually see this play out in the economy. So the thing about hard things to make is that they stay hard to make, even if you print a lot of money. Which means that the more robust products and the more solid, like the genuine food, here's something to keep in mind or think about, is that if your food isn't increasing with the price of, with inflation, then you should wonder if your food ingredients are not the same as they used to be. Because typically food from a technology and innovation point of view, solid high quality food doesn't just kind of have a doubling every year. We're not talking about tech. We're not talking about storage size of a hard drive. Unless the quality of the steak massively degrades, you're not going to get a lot of price decrease in a steak. At least in the context of the amount of work and value you have to put in order to get a high quality steak. So, if your food is not going up in price at the rate of inflation, you should worry about the quality of your food. But here's the thing, wages are sticky. Wages stay where they are. And in fact, it's almost crazy to think that this isn't just blatantly obvious. From all of the, even the things that Keynesians teach about economics, is that wages are sticky. Wages are one of the slowest moving prices in the economy, which means that your income is the last thing to adjust. Everything is going to get harder and more expensive before you ever see a salary increase. So what does that mean? Here's the thing, is nobody can sell you a product for more price than you're getting paid. They can't charge a higher price than you can afford. So a lot of people think that, like, oh, consumer price index is, you know, some sort of interesting thing about, you know, keeping up with inflation and stuff, but quite the opposite is true. Consumer prices are a reflection of wages. The quality and density of the product you are buying is a better indication of the actual inflation happening. So let's say, take a hypothetical where there's two different wine companies, and they boast as, you know, being high quality, like really good wine, tasting good, blah blah blah. Like, you know, they've got the whole package. Then we get hit with 10% inflation. One company decides not to compromise, that they're not going to cut back on anything. They're going to keep the labeling. They want to keep a consistent product. Well, now they have to raise prices by 10%. The other company decides they're going to cut corners. They're not going to let the grapes ferment for as long. They're going to make cheaper labeling, or they're going to use thinner glass in the bottle, whatever it is. But they start to degrade it a little bit. Maybe they water the wine down just a hair, so that they can keep the price. From the market perspective, two things happen. One is the company that raised their prices gets a net negative feedback. Everybody thinks, what a shitty company raising their prices. And now they actually have to respond to their customers. They have to defend their position. And what's happened with the customer wages? The customers can't afford the more expensive wine. They now simply cannot afford the thing they used to buy at the same price as the other. So out of the two companies, the one that lowered the quality in an invisible way by being dishonest looks like the more reliable, more stable company. So they actually get a positive brand response for making the quality of their wine shittier, whereas the actual good company gets a negative brand hit and loses customers. Not even for the brand hit, even excluding that, they simply lose customers who can no longer afford it because inflation has gone up, but their wages haven't yet. And this is just on a single round of inflation. And you're going to see this in every single product, in every single service. We're going to cut a little bit more out of customer service. We're going to water down our food. We're going to take out those fatty oils, and we're going to put in like the healthy animal oils, and we're going to put in seed oils or soybean oil or corn oil. We're going to take out that robust flavor, and we're going to use shittier meat and shittier ingredients. We're going to use bleached flour, and then we're going to put all the flavor back in with a cocktail of Monsanto chemicals that are all made to just mimic it, and we're going to stick a whole bunch of fructose in there to mask the fact that it's not even real food anymore. And this just happens over and over and over and over again. And everybody who goes in looking to buy something at a price is always and forever grabbing something a little bit cheaper, a little bit shittier, a little bit lower quality, with a little bit less food in it. And they're being told all of the things they want to hear. Of course, the corn company and the soy company start drumming up and funding a bunch of studies about how animal foods are really bad for you, and steak is gonna kill you, and butter is awful for you. That's why we have this soy corn fructose replacement for you. It's the healthy alternative, and it also is the only thing that they can afford. So they love being told that they're eating the healthy version, they're eating the low-fat version, they're eating vitamin-enriched cereal, which is literally bleached corn and wheat that has no nutritional value whatsoever, in which they've essentially crunched up a multivitamin and dusted it across all of their fake box of cellulose. This happens when wood components get replaced with plastic components, metal components get replaced with thinner aluminum components, glass bottles get replaced with plastic bottles, and the list just goes on and on and on. And none of this is to say that some of these choices might not have been made in a market, but if people weren't being constantly made poor, if there wasn't constant trillions of dollars of inflation, and of those two wine companies, one cheapened their product to try to undersell the other one, now look who has the instability problem. Now who looks like the reliable, long-term, stable, solid product company? The one who actually engaged in solid winemaking and keeps selling for the stable price that they can sell it for. And the one who aggressively cheapens their product to become more and more affordable just gets thought of as a cheap, crappy alternative to real wine. There would be no sustainable market for soy, corn-infused everything because you would actually be able to afford real food. And all of the massive market backing and financing that then fueled this garbage scientific era of manipulating bullshit studies to come up with any conclusion they could possibly want, and just declaring it out to, again, a population that just thinks if the authority says it, then it must be true. And it doesn't matter if they controlled for absolutely nothing in this study. It doesn't matter if it's a broad study and they just ask, did you eat any meat? And then you find out that 9 times out of 10, the person who went to McDonald's and got a fake burger with plastic ingredients and soy-covered industrial motor oil French fries and all of this, like, just this disgusting, unhealthy, inflammatory meal, and this is what they call meat, and then they release a study that says eating meat will give you a heart attack? And so everybody buys it because they're just told to do what the science says. Because when they did that with their textbook, they got a gold star. And they don't have the time for anything. They're working their ass off. They're having to buy cheap and shitty wine. They're having to buy bleached enriched wheat flour food that's just a substitute to make it look like and taste like real food. And their washing machine just broke, and they now have to pay $300 to get somebody to replace one $2 component that they can't even fix themselves, which they don't have the time to do or the knowledge to do anyway. And they got brain fog from all of the sugar and inflammatory foods that they're eating anyway. They're unhealthy. They just had to go to the doctor because they've got another chronic disorder. So they've been put on antidepressants because they just hate everything, and they don't understand why the hell nothing is moving forward, why they can't get out of their fucking situation. And then another thing breaks on their damn car. It's time to just finance and replace the stupid thing. fiat, bad money, is one of the most destructive forces in society. I truly believe that. Because society is literally a creation of positive feedback incentives, and fiat money turns it into a negative feedback. It confuses, it muddies, it sends malinformation into the network and disallows that communication from occurring, which means it destroys society. It destroys the fundamental piece of our intersubjective puzzle that allows society to grow and scale to begin with. And it won't get better. We will just keep going through this cycle of total collapse and then some sense of stability and sense of actually pulling together a period of growth, then a shift toward abuse and more expansion of debt, forgetting what it was like when everything was a disaster, rehashing all of the irresponsible bad incentive behaviors until things grow and worsen and become more and more unsustainable until it all finally breaks again and we go through a freaking disaster and we start from square one. The only way to stop this crap is to fix the money. Because if we fix the money, then we can actually scale society sustainably. That is the whole point. So we will be back with another in the Fiat series, probably next week, actually. So I hope you enjoyed this one. Don't forget to check out the Cold Card Hardware Wallet and Swan Bitcoin to get your Bitcoin and stick it on your cold card. And also, don't forget, Keet has actually finally launched Broadcast Rooms. And I have officially made a room for the Guy Swan Network, which includes AI Unchained, Shitcoin Insider, when I still get to those episodes, Bitcoin Audible, and even an unnamed project that is soon to come. It will have all of my development projects, my memes, everything. I will keep you up to date. It is a decentralized center for all the things that Guy Swan is working on and the things that I want to make. And I hope you join me over there. I will have the link in the show notes. It'll be good for 2 weeks. And after that, you'll just need to hit me up or DM me to get a link. But I hope to see you over there. I am Guy Swan, and until then, everybody, take it easy, guys.
Everywhere I travel, tiny life, single serving sugar, single serving cream, single pat of butter, the microwave cordon bleu hobby kit, shampoo conditioner combos, sample packaged mouthwash, tiny bars of soap. The people I meet on each flight, their single-serving friends. Between takeoff and landing, we have our time together, but that's all we get.